Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Okay, well, welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. And today we have Dr. Rachel Farby. She is an Associate Professor in the Center for Bioethics and Humanities at Sunny Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. And her research focuses on the ethics of policies that affect immigrant health. So Rachel, you're very, very welcome today. And thank you so much for coming at sort of relatively short notice. You obviously have a long-standing interest in a research program centered on immigration policy. And you've already been on our podcast once. And you're the first guest to come back. So thank you. But today we were really hoping to focus on, your thoughts about the recent memoranda that have been issued to ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, that's concerning healthcare institutions, educational institutions, and places of worship, and the idea that they're no longer safe and that now ICE agents can go into those previously sensitive locations and, you know, take people away and potentially deport them. So there's been a lot of activity in ethics and law circles and healthcare circles, a lot of webinars and, people really trying to get their heads around this and what things that clinicians and ethicists can do. So we're really happy to have you here to help us think about that more and really get the word out to everybody. So can you explain sort of in practice what this means for each of those types of institutions?
Sure. Yeah. And thank you for the invitation to come speak about this. So historically, ICE was not supposed to conduct immigration enforcement actions near protected locations, except under very limited circumstances. And those circumstances included things like a threat to national security or, you know, a sort of real risk to public safety. And so in January, the Trump administration issued a new memorandum sort of revoking that guidance, which had most recently been updated in 2021 under President Biden. And the new memo advised, instead of, you know, saying maybe don't do enforcements in those places, it struck that guidance and said instead that ICE agents should use, quote, a healthy dose of common sense, unquote, in deciding when and where to take enforcement actions. And so what this means for hospitals, for schools, for places of worship that were all sort of historically excluded, except under those limited circumstances from immigration enforcement, is that there's no longer that expectation that they'll refrain from enforcing immigration law in those places. And so now, with the new guidance, ICE can show up to a public space in a hospital, in a school, like, for instance, an emergency department waiting room that's a public space, to look for people that they are seeking to enforce immigration law against. So people who are undocumented and who they are seeking to deport. The sort of key word there, though, is public. So under the Fourth Amendment, we still have a reasonable expectation of privacy in private spaces. And so an emergency department waiting room is pretty clearly a public space. But in, you know, a private exam room within a hospital is not, right? And so there are still barriers around where ICE can and can't go in hospitals when they don't have a warrant, right? They could enter the public waiting room. They can't enter a private space. And that's also true, like in a school, maybe they can get to the front office, but they can't go into classrooms if there's an expectation that those classrooms are private. And that expectation can be litigated in different ways. You know, it's sort of based on a reasonable person's expectation of privacy. And so hospitals are going to need to, and schools and places of worship are going to be really need to be careful about labeling places as public or private, right? So for instance, going back to that ED example, if ICE can walk in through the front door and be in that waiting room, there should be a sign posted sort of for the next set of doors saying this is a private space, right? And if there is signage indicating that, then they're going to need a warrant, and not just any warrant. In order to search a place that is private, they're going to need a judicial warrant, which is a warrant that has been signed by a judge, and that names the action that they're seeking to take. So the particular person they're looking for, whether they can seize stuff, right? Or if they're just looking for a person, that should all be spelled out on the warrant and it should be signed by a judge. There are also what are called administrative warrants, and these are not actually warrants at all. They're sort of like ICE work orders, where maybe an ICE administrator said, here's your list of people to go find them. And they might present that and call it a warrant, but if it's not been signed by a judge, it's not enforceable against these private spaces.
Thanks for that clear explanation. And Kirk, do you have any thoughts on this, given your background working with congregations?
Yes. So I guess our listeners don't know that I'm also a pastor of a church, and we specifically am the United Church of Christ is our denomination, and the Central Atlantic Conference of the United Church of Christ was on a lawsuit with 27 other religious institutions to sue that we do have a constitutional right to be safe places and spaces for immigrants and refugees. And thankfully, the judge agreed and blocked the particular orders that, you know, ICE could go into different religious institutions, settings, and of course, perform raids. So that is absolutely, you know, wonderful, but also a reminder that you have a voice and that whatever issue there is, you should speak up and find effective ways to protect those who are most vulnerable in our society. We do have a member that also helps out immigrants as part of her particular service and ministry as well. And there are a lot of other organizations reaching out to us that had federal funding, but of course that funding has been halted, and they're trying to find particular ways to assist this particular vulnerable demographic in our society. So I do have experience in that, and it is very troubling when you have individuals coming to you that are really anxious and fearful and scared, and rightfully so, right? Because their whole livelihood could just be, in a moment's notice, be completely changed for the worse. But yeah, those are my perspectives as a clergy, that we promote safe spaces, and I'm really happy that the judge blocked what, of course, the current administration is trying to do in religious settings and institutions.
Great. Well, thanks for that update. So Rachel, then, can you kind of outline some strategies that, you know, desk staff in the ED could do, or leadership could do, or clinicians themselves could do, and maybe also an educational, sort of the equivalent across educational back, you know, settings, what people can do to kind of prevent any arrest that might not actually have the judicial warrant?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, like, the strategies that I'm going to outline, I did not come up with, right? These are coming from places like Mark Kashevsky's Sanctuary Doctoring Toolkit and Altaf Sadi's Doctors for Immigrants Toolkit, which are both great resources for people working in healthcare. I've also got some great pointers from the President's Alliance for Immigration and Higher Education. The disclaimer, I'm not coming up with these on the spot, but some ideas for how to protect students, protect patients, protect your people who are coming to your religious institution. That the sort of one that I already alluded to is labeling private spaces, right? If you have a sign that says this is a private space, it's a private space, right? And so that's a good, easy thing you can do. Just tape up a sign that says private. Other things that you're going to want to do is particularly in hospitals and schools where you have front desk staff, is to train those people on what to do if ICE shows up. So training your front desk staff, your hospital or school security, to recognize a judicial versus an administrative warrant, and also how to respond in the moment. So to say, I'm not authorized to provide the information you're seeking, or I'm not authorized to grant you entry. Please wait while I go get someone who is, right? And then you can seek out, hospital security or an administrator who can do that. And in the meantime, document everything that you see, document what ICE is asking for, and what they're doing in your space. And another sort of key here that we should be mindful of, and I don't really have a good solution to this, but for instance, at my own hospital, the policy is we all say, I'm not authorized to provide that information or to grant you access. And then we're supposed to go get university police, right? And they are supposed to be the ones to handle it, which is, on the one hand, great. They are probably best positioned to recognize a judicial warrant. They have that training. But on the other hand, for a lot of undocumented people, law enforcement is law enforcement. And if you have a history of being afraid of law enforcement, and you see that the university police are the ones who are expected to be protecting you right now, that's not necessarily comforting. It's not necessarily going to reassure you that your rights are going to be protected because of that history of sort of tension with law enforcement. And so, you know, there it may be that university police, hospital police are not the best people to be interfacing, you know, in that public space in front of the undocumented people who are at risk. But again, I don't have a good answer. I think that's just something to be mindful of. Other things that you can do, know your rights training is huge, right? Faculty, staff, clinicians, everyone involved in these institutions should know what I'm saying right now, right? They should be trained on how to respond. And on top of that, we should have practice, right? Like we have fire drills in our hospital. We should have ICE drills. We should know how to put these practices into play when they become necessary. Another sort of easy thing that hospitals or schools could do is to just make available the red cards. I don't know if you've seen these, but they sort of have a list of rights and how to respond if you are an undocumented person or a person at risk of deportation and you're confronted with ICE. They're just like business card sized cards. You could leave a stack of them on a side table in an ED for people to pick up. And it just gives guidance about what your rights are. So that's a real easy thing that you could put into place. A thing that clinicians and sort of school counselors, people who work directly with students, can do also is help support emergency planning with those patients or students. So for instance, if you're a clinician and maybe you're a pediatrician, you have a parent, you have a kid in front of you, and you know that the parent there is maybe at risk of deportation, you know, saying, here's some guidance around making a plan for what might happen if you do have to leave the country suddenly, right? Who's going to take care of your children? Where are they going to go? Having that sort of planned out can maybe help ease some of the stress of having this hanging. I mean, it doesn't fix it, right? It's awful if you get separated from your child in that way. But just knowing that there's a plan will make your child safer. And then something that I've been really pushing my institution to do is to establish relationships with local legal aid organizations, particularly for our students, but I think it would also be helpful for patients to be able to make some sort of referral. I know our institution can't provide the legal support directly, but having that connection, knowing, you know, and making it clear to our students, if you have immigration trouble, this organization is our partner. They will like reach out to them and they will help defend you in this case. So those are a few strategies that hospitals and schools can take.
Yeah, no, that's very practical and useful. So just before I hand it over to Kirk, so there's a lot of planning and those things that you've mentioned are really, really useful and something we should all be spreading around. And we're going to be putting those resources up on our website as well. And thank you for mentioning Dr. Koszewski and his work. So we've seen activity in places like restaurants, and in fact, one here in Rochester closed because someone was arrested and they didn't have enough staff. My understanding is, listening to some of the legal scholars, healthcare law scholars, that hasn't been a lot so far actually in our healthcare institutions, but presumably, obviously, there's a lot of fear anyway. That's part of the purpose of a lot of this. But I'm presuming that people are, you know, not coming to school or college or potentially not showing up for appointments just because of the concerns that this might, you know, actually be happening or activity could increase in those spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that is accurate. And I think that that might be part of the point, right? So on the one hand, obviously one of the goals of increased immigration enforcement in these spaces is to increase immigration enforcement and get people out. But I feel like another sort of intended side effect is to basically kick undocumented people out of public life, right? Make it harder for them to access the services to which they are entitled. Undocumented people are entitled to a public education, right? They are entitled to healthcare in our emergency departments. Those are legal rights. And so these sort of immigration enforcement in these spaces, in addition to just leading to more deportation, will lead to fear that causes people to withdraw from those services. And so it's been frustrating for me to hear from administrators, nothing has changed. The law is the same. You know, we're going to keep doing things the way we've always done them until we're told otherwise, which is great. But also things have changed, particularly if you are a person who is at risk, right? It doesn't feel like nothing's changed. It feels like a lot has changed. And so I wish our institutions could do more sort of proactively, right? Proactively plan and anticipate what might be coming and do more to reassure our patients, our students, that we have their back. Another frustration, and this is, it comes with the disclaimer that I am not a lawyer, but my frustration has been with lawyers who are very risk averse, right? And not willing to tell the institution that they can stand up for these people, right? And that's their job. I understand that lawyers are supposed to protect the institution that they work for. But institutions have an ethical responsibility to protect their patients and their students. And that duty should be guiding the decisions that our leaders make. And the lawyers who work for them should be prepared to defend that decision and that strategy rather than circumventing and saying, we can't adopt that strategy because it's risky. And that has been a frustration that I've been experiencing over the past month and a half with this policy.
Yeah, I definitely noticed in one of the legal discussions that, you know, the clinicians were much more focused on the patient's rights and the lawyers were sort of kind of dodging the issue a little bit, I would say. Sorry, Kirk.
Oh, no, it's absolutely fine, Amelia. And again, thanks again for coming, Dr. Fabi. So, and we did allude to this a little bit earlier, but maybe you have some more ideas regarding using the state's power and, of course, the power of the courts. What do you hope can be done by states and courts to counteract these moves more broadly? And I know that there have been things that have been done previously that thankfully worked in the favor of immigrant and refugees. Is there other things that you haven't seen that you think should be done to promote and have more protections for immigrants, refugees, and displaced persons?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem right now with getting states to act on this particular policy is that there are so many policies that are bad that they're pushing back against, right? So like, for instance, one of the very first things the Trump administration did when they came in was to issue that executive action on birthright citizenship, right? And we saw tons of states push back and sue to say, actually, you don't have the right to strip birthright citizenship out of the Constitution. That's not how our like rule of law works. And there are just like countless other things that they're constantly responding to. There's a really great website sort of tracking all of the state actions. Well, first of all, the Trump actions and then the responses of the states. And it's on the Immigration Law Tracking Project, which is a collaboration between Yale and Stanford Law Schools, which I check basically every day to see like what horrible new thing is coming down, you know, the pipeline for immigration. And what are states doing to respond? And so I find it a little, you know, encouraging to see that states are pushing back. They are taking every single one of these actions to court. And as you mentioned earlier, a couple of religious institutions have had success seeking injunctions. Particularly, there was a group of Quakers, a congregation of Quakers in Maryland, that got an injunction against specifically this rescission of the sensitive locations policy. Another group that is seeking a similar injunction is Denver Public Schools, right, to sort of protect their students in a school setting. So I think the courts will, they'll be taking these cases, and hopefully they will continue to sort of enjoin and stop these policies until they're actually, because that's the thing, right? This is all executive action. It's the laws are not changing, right? The Trump administration is issuing these executive orders, which, Trump himself spent Obama's entire presidency criticizing his use of executive action, basically saying, if you can't get laws passed, you don't deserve to govern. So that reversal is fascinating. And I think that it leaves room, because he's not doing this through standard lawmaking, or even through traditional rulemaking, through going through a notice and comment period. I think that there is room for courts to stop these things. It's just going to have to, it's going to take time, unfortunately. And in the meantime, a lot of people are at risk. A lot of people are withdrawing from public life, as I mentioned, and that's going to affect their health and it's going to affect their well-being. So, I hope to see more from states. I hope to see more from the courts, and I am trying to cling to some optimism that that will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And what also this has really revealed is that how integral immigrants, and of course, we already know we are a nation of immigrants, unless you're Native American. Somewhere down the line in your family history, they have come from wherever you originated to America. So we have to obviously realize and acknowledge that, even though some folks forget that, yeah, we came from somewhere, right? I think that is integrally important to highlight that immigrants are integral in our society in many different ways. And a lot of people are finding out the hard way. Economically, immigrants are extremely important, right? Usually they take jobs and duties that usually the average American would never dream or even dare to take. And it has a lot of not just ethical and moral implications, which we just talked about, but it has a lot of course, financial implications. Those individuals that gather all of our groceries, and then folks are complaining about, oh, well, prices are high. Well, guess what? It's going to get even higher because we don't have the people to actually harness and gather those particular products and produce that we, I think, take for granted for on a day-to-day basis when we go to the supermarket, right? So it's something that are really naive in thinking that we could just move people and everything will be okay. That's not how our society is structured, and that's not how it should be structured. I personally will say that. Before I ask you another question, Dr. Fabi, I just want everyone to know another resource. So there's the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, www.ILRC.org. And they actually have many, many languages of red cards that you could order for yourself or other individuals. You could actually go on their website and print out red cards. And for those that don't know what a red card is basically reminding immigrants of their rights. So it basically says you have constitutional rights. Do not open the door if an immigration agent is knocking on the door. Do not answer any questions from an immigrant agent if they try to talk to you. You have the right to remain silent. Do not sign anything without first speaking to a lawyer. You have the right to speak with a lawyer. If you are outside of your home, ask the agent if you are free to leave. And if they say yes, leave calmly. They said, give this card to the agent. If you are inside of your home, show the card through the window or slide it under the door. You also have a right to say, I do not wish to speak with you, answer your questions, or sign or hand you any documents based on, as we talked about, right, the Fifth Amendment rights under the United States Constitution. I do not give you permission to enter my home based on my Fourth Amendment rights under the United States Constitution, unless you have a warrant, which, of course, we talked about earlier, to enter, signed by a judge or a magistrate with my name on it that you slide under the door. I do not give you permission to search any of my belongings based on, as we spoke about before, my Fourth Amendment rights. And of course, I choose to exercise my constitutional rights. So this is what is actually on the red card, and this has been disseminated to individuals. So you can know your rights, because if you don't know your rights, you could easily be taken advantage of. But I thought it was a good point just to pause, just to read the red card and give our listeners a resource if they need it to where to go and retrieve that information. Speaking of immigrants and immigration, what are some myths? Because there's a lot of misunderstanding about how immigrants contribute to our country. What are some myths that you know about that should be debunked about immigrants?
Yeah, I think you already alluded to the main one, which is this idea of sort of deservingness, right? What do you deserve if you are an immigrant living in this country? And I think there are myths that, you know, your deservingness is based on where you were born, right? Or if you are here and you are undocumented, then you have in some way done something so morally wrong that you are no longer deserving of the social protections that we grant to each other as members of a society. And I think that that's just incorrect, right? I think morally, legally, frankly, that is incorrect. People will often say things like, well, they don't pay taxes, so they don't deserve our public goods. But that's also not true. Undocumented immigrants pay tons of money in taxes. Many file actually income taxes using like Social Security numbers that are not real, right? Which means they're paying taxes that they will never see back. They'll never be able to claim that Social Security. And for many people who are undocumented and paying taxes under sort of an ITIN, some sort of a tax identification number, the Trump administration recently announced that they're going to start using that information against undocumented immigrants. So they're making it harder. They're punishing people essentially for paying taxes. So that, you know, the taxes thing aside, there are other reasons why people are deserving of social protection and social goods. I think I may have talked about this in the last time I was on the podcast, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but I often go back to Joseph Karen's theory that he puts forward in his book, The Ethics of Immigration, that the deservingness is grounded in our social connectedness to one another, that, you know, we are neighbors, we are colleagues, we go to church together, we go to school together, we go to synagogue together, we know one another, and we... And that's where we generate our obligations to one another, right? Is in this web of social connectedness and social embeddedness within our own community. And that doesn't have anything to do with where you were born, right? It has to do with how do you relate to another person? It's a very social view of, you know, where deservingness comes from. And then there's another sort of a way that we could approach, particularly the healthcare question, and you know, deservingness of healthcare. I like the theory that Wendy Permit and Patricia Illingworth put forward in their book, The Health of Newcomers, that these obligations come from solidarity, right? And particularly in healthcare, immigrants make up a huge chunk of our healthcare workforce, not just doctors and nurses, but home health aides. And so our solidarity obligations are generated in that way, right? They help provide healthcare to citizens. Citizens should also be helping to provide health back, right? Health is a public good. Having it doesn't mean that no one else can have it. It is non-excludable and non-rivalrous. And so we should be ensuring the health of all, regardless of where they were born, because they are here and we take care of each other and our neighbors. So that is, that's a long answer to your question about myths that need to be debunked. But I think that this deservingness thing is what I always come back to.
No, absolutely, Dr. Fabian. Of course, we love long answers in our podcast, so that's completely fine. And just to give a quick statistic, a 2017 report from the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy highlights that undocumented immigrants pay an estimated $11.74 billion in state and local taxes a year. the U.S. Social Security Administration estimated that in 2010, undocumented immigrants and their employers paid $13 billion in payroll taxes alone for benefits they will never, ever get. So folks that are U.S. citizens, you're actually financially benefiting from the work and the labor of undocumented immigrants that usually isn't highlighted. And I just wanted to post that particular statistics on the benefit, of course, of having immigrants, but also a more humane and cohesive process for folks that have been and worked very hard and long in this country to have opportunity to become a U.S. citizen as well. Because the immigration system, you see this from every political spectrum, Democrats, Republicans, independents, libertarians, everyone agrees that the immigration system is broken. But okay, so what are the solutions, right? And of course, that is a more broader and more grander conversation to have. But again, the human aspect, as you said, having solidarity for individuals, I think that is particularly important. My second to last question is, you mentioned a book that talks about newcomers and health. Do you know you said The Health of Newcomers, is that the title?
I believe so. Let's see. Okay. I have it right behind me.
Okay. Because I Googled it and I could not find it, but I love, number one, because I'm just being selfish. I apologize. I want to get it myself, but I think if those are those interested in reading about, you know, health equity, public health and immigration, I think that'll be a great resource for everyone.
Yeah, it's The Health of Newcomers by Patricia Illingworth and Wendy Parmet. It is, like you can see here, I've read it multiple times. It is marked the heck up, but I find it really useful for thinking through these ideas and okay. what we owe, particularly in the healthcare space, to one another.
And it's fairly recent, came out in 2017. So The Health of Newcomers, Immigration, Health Policy, and the Case for Global Solidarity. Great. So that would be definitely on my reading list. So thank you. Lastly, and again, this is a philosophical question. And every time either Amelia and I ask this question, it's interesting regarding the philosophy of action for bioethicists. Some argue that no, bioethicists really shouldn't do anything. It's more of a theoretical approach. And then some said, no, actually, as bioethicists, we should, it just can't just be theory, right? But it also should be in action. It should be in the way we advocate physically, politically, financially for the bioethical ills that we see in society. What is your take on what bioethicists should do and their role in the current issues that really plague us in immigration?
I love this question. I have a very, I have strong feelings about it, right? So I have also heard.
Do tell.
I have also heard with frustration, people say things like we should be neutral, right? We should write our little papers and we should publish them in our little journals. And then it's on other people to read them and to put those ideas into practice. And I think that that is nonsense, right? What is the point of having normative arguments, of believing that something is the correct action or the correct policy or the correct value to espouse, and then doing nothing about it? That to me seems like a bad use of time, right? So I think that it is very clear that if you have a strong moral argument and you're able as a bioethicist through your training and through your experience to clarify the moral stakes, right? What are the obligations? In this case, we're talking about the obligations of healthcare institutions, of schools, of clinicians, of educators. What are the stakes and what are the principles that should guide our action? And if you have a clear view on those things, then it is incumbent upon you to put that into practice, right? I'm a big fan of praxis, right? I do this research, I have my beliefs, and now I'm going to go try to make them a reality so that maybe I can put myself out of work. Like, I would love to not have to write or research about how we could better treat undocumented immigrants in our society because they are treated as well as possible. I would love to not have to do that anymore. And so I think bioethicists have an obligation to pull together those moral arguments with the practical arguments, like the ones that you mentioned earlier, Kirk, about taxation and about like holding together our economy. Those are practical arguments. And if you can meld those things, those moral and practical arguments, that's really compelling from an advocacy perspective. And if you can, on top of that, pull in some narratives, right? If you can go speak to people who are directly impacted by these policies and get their stories, you are like perfectly positioned to do advocacy, not just with policymakers, but with the public, right? We are trained at, you know, spreading our message. I didn't say that very eloquently, so maybe maybe I'm not as well trained as I should be. But, you know, if you are good at writing and communicating, you should be communicating these arguments, not just to our peers and journals, but to the public and to policymakers. And I also think on top of that, right, I think there's a meta level to this. Obviously, we have obligations to advocate for just policy in whatever space we work in. But I think above that, we should also be working towards reshaping the political space in which these policies operate, right? It's not enough to oppose a single policy or slate of policies that we think is unjust. We should be working toward broader social and political change, where the sort of policies that we're talking about today would be unthinkable, right? So as bioethicists, as educators, we should be working to change the hearts and minds of the next generation so that the policies that we're talking about today we wouldn't have to have these conversations because the political space has shifted. And I think that that is another part of our obligation as educators and as bioethicists.
No, absolutely. I agree. What sense does it make for us to have all of these, you know, credentials and letters behind our names and degrees and certifications, but does it have any application towards really benefiting society? It's sad, right? And that's why we're in the positions we're in. We're in it to make our society a better place. And passivity is something that doesn't benefit anyone, whether it's just solely in scholarship or in any spectrum of our society, right? So that is definitely a profound point, Dr. Fabi. So thank you. Do you have any other closing comments or thoughts or remarks on how we move forward or any other information you'd like to share with our listening audience?
No, I would just add, we spent today talking primarily about this sensitive locations guidance, and I think that that's really pressing and really top of mind for a lot of people who work in healthcare and work in education. But it is also important to sort of take a wider lens on these immigration policies. And again, I want to plug the Immigration Law Tracking Project. It is a great resource for following more like all of the policies, and that we should, you know, make sure that we are keeping our scope wide and not just looking at the policies that directly impact us in the healthcare space, but that are affecting people sort of across their life spectrum that are coming out of this administration.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. It's always good to have you back for the second time. And I'm sure it's not going to be the last, maybe the third, fourth, fifth, 20th time, whatever it takes. But we definitely appreciate your thoughts on this really our current and urgent matter.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chun. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.